And I was just about to say how beautiful this meeting was. I'm not that short. I'm Dan, alcoholic.
Hey, Dan.
And I really do want to thank you all for the welcomes that you gave me. And what a courteous, fine meeting this is. It reminds me of my home group. I have a sobriety date. It's January 14th, 1994. My home group is the Inland Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It meets every Monday night at 7:30. It doesn't matter if it's Christmas. We're there. I have a sponsor, Roman C. from San Dimas, and then I have another sponsor, Walt B. from Wrightwood. There's a reason for that. One of them is very sane and, you know, easygoing, and the other one is just crazy out of his mind. And it's a balance for me, you know. I want to thank my friend Kevin for driving us up here tonight and Rob for that 10-minute talk. In fact, I was going to invite you back up and let you finish that story, man, but, you know, it's good. And I would like to thank Mark for inviting me up here to share with you guys tonight what I can. But this is an honest program, and I don't want to tell a lie like that. So, no, thank you, Mark, so much. I appreciate it. Really do. As I said, my sobriety date is January 14th, 1994. And I have a wife that's in this program also, and her sobriety date is December 1st of 93. So if you do the math real quick, she has 45 days more sobriety than I do. And believe me, she uses it. The only reason she has 45 days more than me is because she was a lot worse than me and I had to give her a head start. So it works out well. But, you know, we'll have a little tiff at home or something, and I'll be standing there looking at her and she'll go, "Don't worry about it. You'll understand in 45 days. Part of Rob's story is part of mine. You know, my father left when I was a year and a half old. I took that to heart as I grew up as a little kid. I thought that he left because I came along. I have an older sister, and he stayed while she was there. And then as soon as I showed up, he takes off. But that come to find out there was a different reason for that than wasn't me. But you know how we get those thoughts in our heads, especially as little kids. And that was one of mine. So it left a big hole in me. I'm the product of alcoholic parents. My mother was, most of her life she was a barmaid or a bartender. My dad was a truck driver and a bus driver. And so he drove around the country a lot. But like I said, I didn't even know him until I turned 12. But before I get to be 12, there's a few other things that went on. I had three stepfathers before I met my real dad. The first one was a full-blooded Apache Indian, and he was, let's say, he disciplined with some force. And so I got a lot of beatings from him, but a lot of them I deserved. I was a rotten little kid, I think. You know, him and my mom would take off on these 4 or 5 day binges and just be my sister and I at home alone. And so one day I decided I'm going to try smoking. And so I stole one of my mom's cigarettes and I lit it up. And as soon as I lit it up, I heard that truck coming up the gravel driveway. And I panicked and I took that cigarette and I threw it under my mom's dresser. I guess my mom wasn't a real good housekeeper under there because there was a lot of dust bunnies and shit under there that caught on fire. And the whole dresser was aflame when they came in the door. And they asked who did it. And of course, I pointed to my sister. Needless to say, they soon found out that was not the truth. I had another stepfather that was just mentally abusive as all heck, and I ended up with a half-brother from that man. And then by the time I turned 12 years old, my father got in touch with my grandmother, who was our savior as a child. You know, she used to come and rescue us from our house when my parents were gone for days and take us over to our house and feed us and stuff like that. But my dad got in touch with him, and he said that, you know, he wanted to take me out to California for a two-week vacation. And, of course, I begged and begged and begged to go because, believe it or not, even though I thought he hated me, he was my hero, even though I'd never even met him. I mean, I saw a picture of him in the military when he was 19, and that's the only thing I had to go on. And when I met him, I came out here for a two-week vacation, and I've been here ever since. So little did I know that my father was an alcoholic also, but my stepmom covered it up really well. She was a great enabler for him. You know, all those times that he would be gone for days and days and days. Oh, and he's on a business trip. You know, he had to go out of town on a business trip and stuff like this and that. And then finally one day I was walking down the street going to my buddy's house. We were going to go to the beach. And my dad was on one of his business trips. And he comes flying out of a bar that we're walking past. And he's got a guy in a headlock pulling him out of the bar and stuffing his head between a tire and a curb and start stomping on it. And that kind of opened my eyes that, you know, hey, I don't think he was out of town on business at this time. But we seemed to get along pretty well. You know, he took me fishing, stuff like that. We had a pretty good relationship as far as that goes. And, you know, all I ever wanted from him was to hear him say, I love you, son, and, you know, I'm proud of you, things like that. So I played sports the whole time, football, baseball, wrestling, you know, you name it, I was in it. And my dad could never find the time to come to any of my games or anything like that. So when I was a senior in high school and I was playing varsity football, he decided he was going to come to the father-son night, which is, you know, you're wearing your jersey on the field and he's wearing the opposing jersey up in the stands so you can see which kid belongs to what parent. And he came to the game, him and my uncle, and they were both drunk on their ass, and they were cheering for the other team. So I learned a long time ago, be careful what you pray for, because I found out that it doesn't always work your way. Not long after that, I graduated high school, and I went into the military, joined the Army, and went through all the boot camp up at Fort Ord, and Fort Lost in the Woods, Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, in the middle of winter, learning how to run heavy equipment, which is what I did for the rest of my life, but I loved the hell out of it. But anyhow, my first duty station was Thailand, and I was 18 years old, and I wanted to retire there as soon as I got there. I'm good, right here, this is fine. We were 63 miles out in the middle of the jungle. You know, of course, we had an EM club, we had trampolines, we had, you know, a lot of things. But then just down the road, about 5 miles, was a little village. And that was our main drinking establishment. So we're, and Thailand, believe it or not, has a little beer called Singha. And for 5 baht, which is like 25 cents American money, you can buy a 40 of this. And when they pop the top on that, it smells just like formaldehyde. And when you drink it, it tastes like formaldehyde a lot. But it did get you messed up in a hurry. And so we spent a lot of money. I spent a lot of quarters on that Singha. The other thing good about Thailand is that they have this little thing over there called Thai weed. This I didn't even have to pay for, really. You could go out into Papa San's field, and you know, we had those military fatigue pants on, and you could stuff both of your fatigue pants as full as you could get with Thai weed for a pack of Salems and an orange. And what a deal, right? Now, the only problem with that was, you know, they frown on selling zigzags, rolling papers in the PX. So, thinking swiftly, we're on these big pieces of heavy equipment, and they have air-operated windshield wipers on them. So what we would do was pull the airline off of that valve, put a filtered cigarette on there, turn the valve on, and it would shoot all the tobacco up out of your cigarette, and you had a place to pack it. Now, a lot of the mechanics were complaining that, you know, they were getting on all these machines and there's tobacco everywhere. What's going on with you guys? You know, they had no idea what we were doing. But that was about the only time in my life that I enjoyed smoking pot. I mean, it raced you up, but yet my jaw hurt so bad the next day after the first time I did it. I mean, we laughed and smiled all night long. Wasn't long we were, well, the other thing good about Thailand was, like I said, that little village down the road. I rented a little bungalow down there, and for $65 a month, it was stocked full of Singha, it was stocked full of Thai weed, and there was a little puying there that took care of everything else, kept the house clean, cooked for you, and all of that good stuff. For 65 bucks a month, what a deal, you know? That's why I kept saying, no, I'm good here. Just leave me here. This is fine. So they have a little thing over there called a water festival, which it's a big festival for like 3-4 weeks, and it's supposed to be helping to bring on the monsoon rains, you know, for the season. And the idea was, is like, you'd just be walking down the ville there or something, and somebody would jump out from behind a hooch and throw a bucket of water on you, and then run off laughing like crazy. Thought that was funny. I came out of one of my drinking establishments one day with some brand new city clothes that my mom had sent me from home, and somebody dumped a bucket of water on me. And I was pretty messed up as it was, but I got angry. So I went back to the post, and I stole a 4,000-gallon water truck. And I got my buddy to drive it, and we drove through that ville, and I'm standing on the back of that water truck with that fire hose just blowing people over in the dirt and stuff. We got to the end of the village, and we turned around and started to head back, and they're all standing out in the street, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, we're going to get it now, you know, and they're all out there cheering and laughing and everything. Oh, you number one GI, you know. They thought that was the greatest thing they'd ever seen. It wasn't long after that we finished the job we were doing there in Thailand, which was building a highway to take ordnance to Nakhon Phnom Air Force Base to do bombing runs over Vietnam. And so we all got to fill out these dream sheets. And what it was is they wanted you to list 3 duty stations you'd like to be sent to next. So my first choice was Hawaii. My second choice was Presidio, San Francisco. And my third choice was Fort MacArthur in San Pedro. 2 weeks later, I got orders for Vietnam. And I'm kind of shocked by this. And I go into the commander's office and I said, excuse me, sir, there must be some mistake here. He goes, what's wrong? And I go, I just got orders for Vietnam. And he goes, Troop, why do you think they call it a dream sheet? Get out of my office, man. So off to Nam Ra. Vietnam was a different kind of place, as most of you have heard or know about. And all I can say is that, you know, the biggest time you're afraid there is your first 2 weeks there and your last 2 weeks there. Your last 2 weeks because you're getting ready to go home and you made it that far. And you really get super, you know, acute to anything going on around you. Came home, when I left Vietnam, I got orders for Presidio, San Francisco. And I was like, okay, well, just took a little time, but they got to me to where I wanted to be. And it's a beautiful post right on the coastline of San Francisco Bay. We would pull guard duty in these empty gun turrets up on the cliffs in the middle of the night with a sterno can under your chair and a blanket around you because it's freezing up there. And I ended up meeting my first wife there. She had 2 little girls when we got together. They were 3 and 4 years old. And once I got out of the Army, we moved down to Orange County, and we found a little place over in Buena Park that we rented, and we were living happily for a while. And I got into construction and was working my way up through the ranks there, getting known as a good operator and stuff, because the Army training really helped me a lot. I mean, I was an apprentice, but I was working at times journeymen work because they could get me for a lot cheaper at the time. So we had this little house going on, and as I said, as I'm working my way up through all of this stuff, I found this another great bargain, you know, just like the Thai weed. I found these Catholic aspirins, 10 in a roll for $1, you know, and I mean, it was amazing. I couldn't believe it. So I got used to using those quite a bit, and then along after that came the Black Beauties. But the thing is, you know, every time I did those things, I started drinking Jack Daniels like a fish and found out, wow, I can drink all this booze and I'm not even feeling it, you know. So it was a perfect combination for me. Things started getting pretty bad as far as I was concerned. I was staying out on the jobs late after work and drinking with the guys and doing the other things we were doing. I think I missed one of my daughter's birthdays and Thanksgiving one year. I failed to make it. And my first wife decided that she didn't want to do anything to do with this anymore. So she told me that they were selling the house we were renting and we had to move out. And I'm going, okay. So I said, I'll go down and get a trailer on the van, you know. So I drove down and rented a trailer and came back from front of the house, and we're loading everything up in the trailer. And I think the only thing left in the house was a 25-inch color TV and my recliner chair and my garage refrigerator. And I hear the van outside start up. And so I go to the front door, and it's my wife with the kids, and she's driving off, waving goodbye. I'm moving in with my sister. I don't know where you're going. And I was heartbroken for about that long. But later on, it was revealed to me that that was the best decision she could have ever made, because it went straight downhill from there. Until I met my current wife, and then it was party hardy. We were, I played a lot of softball back then, and she had a drinking buddy that played on my team, and that's how I met her. So we would go out drinking after the games and stuff, and I'm, you know, kind of schmoozing her and stuff, and finally it came down to where she had to move out of her parents' house and find a roommate. And my buddy Greg, her drinking buddy, tells her, well, Dan's available. He's, you know, he's already raised a couple kids. He knows what it's like, because she had one little girl that was 4 years old when we got together. Now, the other children, I forgot to tell you that I did end up adopting him and raising him until they got out of school, out of high school anyway. But so anyhow, Christy has one little girl named Tori, and she's about 4 years old. So I show up at her house to make their introductions, as Forrest Gump would say. And my eyes are just blood red. I mean, blood red. I'd been up for 4 or 5 days, and of course I claimed there was an infection in my eyes. And I knock on the door, and her mom opens the door, and she looks at me, and her eyes got about that big, and she's going, who are you? I go, I'm Dan. I'm here to see Christy. And so they let me in. It was amazing. But yeah, that was my first meeting of my new in-laws to be. So I took Christy out. We were going to go out to have some dinner or something. I had a big old brand new K5 Blazer at the time. And in the center console, if you opened up, I took everything out of there and I drilled a hole in the bottom of the console. And then I hot glued a tube off the bottom outside the truck. So there was a bag of ice, a bottle of Jack Daniels, and a bunch of Pepsi in that console. And then my visor, you know, there's a little vanity mirror on the back of there, and they got they pop off, and they got these two little round things. They seat themselves perfectly on the drink holders, holds it like a magnet. I mean, won't move or shift or anything. So I had lines chopped up on the mirror when she got in the truck, and it was a match made in heaven. You know, she was like, oh my God, this is fantastic, you know. So we got together and started, you know, settling into a household and stuff, and we did pretty well for a while. And the only thing was, she liked to smoke pot, snort cocaine, and drink Jack Daniels. And I'm doing meth and Jack Daniels. Now, to me, meth is much better because it lasts a lot longer and it's not nearly as expensive as coke. So that was, you know, I would get bills in the mail and I would open one of them and it was like $39, $40. I go, I'm worrying about that right now. I throw it in the trash. So the next one come in, it would be like $350 or something. I said, no, I'm not paying that. And I throw that in the trash. But I had a plan in mind. I told her, then this is the way we need to budget our money. We're going to take and get you off that cocaine. You can snort meth like me and drink Jack Daniels, and I can get it all the pot you want for free, so don't worry about it. And she did. It didn't really help anything. I mean, we started doubling up on the meth and everything. But we moved around quite a bit, too. You know, I mean, the one place we lived at the longest was over in Ontario, and the only reason we lived there for 4 years was because our landlord was a drunk, and he couldn't remember if we paid the rent or not. So I had that made. At that time, I had a buddy of mine that was the cook, and you know, we did a lot of work together. We were getting ready to go out in the desert with a little 12-foot travel trailer and do some work. And his rear end went out of his truck, so we limped it over to my house in Ontario and backed it in the driveway, and we decided, let's just do it here. You know, who will know? We live on a cul-de-sac. Who's going to know? I don't know if you've ever been around this process when it's going on, but it is quite aromatic, so to speak. So this is, by this time we have a baby girl named Janelle, and she was born with microphthalmia, and I'll get into that in a minute. So anyhow, we're doing this cook in our driveway, and like I said, the smell is pretty strong for being on the cul-de-sac, because there's not really any wind coming through there, blowing any of the odor away or anything. So thinking swiftly, I decide, I'll paint the trailer while we're doing this. And that way they'll smell the paint and not the dough. So it's not a bad idea, you know, but when you're painting a 12-foot trailer for 3 days, I mean, come on, you know, it's a bit much. I think weighed about 50 pounds more when it left than when it came in. But he you know, it was the type of situation that, should have never happened. I mean, I've been so fortunate not to have those kids taken away from us, but I'm going to get back to the birth of my daughter, Janelle. Janelle is actually my only daughter, but I have four daughters. They're all my girls, and that's the way it's been for quite a while now. Anyhow, Janelle was born with what they call microphthalmia. It means her left eye never developed all the way, so she was blind in her left eye. And, of course, for me, that was the biggest reason in the world to be mad at God, because he did it. Had nothing to do with what we were doing. It had to do with what he did. So as she grew up, when she became 8 years old, blind in one eye, but we'd taken her to this prosthetic doctor, and he made an eye for her, hand painted it, and her eyes were really like hazel with gold flecks in it and stuff. He matched her eye perfectly and put this prosthetic eye in there. And I mean, if you didn't know, you really couldn't tell that she couldn't see out of that eye. But she decides at 8 years old that she wants to play basketball. And I'm going, I'm not so sure about it. I don't know if you'll have any depth perception, or, you know, you won't be able to see people coming up on your left side and stuff. And in the midst of all this, God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I didn't realize that until I got sober. But he made this little girl the best three-point shooter on every team she played on. She played for Rialto Varsity Basketball. And a lot of these things happened before I got sober. And it was within my capabilities to look back upon things, because I've seen a lot of miracles in my life that I never realized were there until I got sober. And she was one of them, and she is today. So then my daughter, Tori, she was kind of mad at me because she felt it was my fault that her mom was messed up on drugs and alcohol. Tori was the one that would wake up early in the morning and go in there and get the speed pipe off of Christy's face and the cookie that she had smashed on her trying to eat something, and clean her up and then set her up and then go wake up her little sister, you know, to go to school and stuff. So she saw the worst of it, and she had every right to be angry with me, you know. So as time went on, Christy finally decided that she couldn't do this anymore, and she put herself in Gibson House for Women, a rehab place for ladies. Now, the first thing was, I called her parents and asked her where she was, because I did not know. And her dad had two aneurysms on his brain, and he lost the use of his left side. Couldn't hardly talk, couldn't hardly walk, any of those things. And yet he taught himself how to walk again, how to talk again. He even got his driver's license back where he could drive. And I called him up to ask him where Christy was, and he says, I can't tell you that. You know, I really shouldn't tell you that. You can't be with her anymore. And I says, who are you to say that? I go, I think that's her decision, not yours. So he still told me he couldn't say anything, that he couldn't tell me. And I said, well, that's fine. I go, I'll be at your front door in about 5 minutes. I'm going to beat the hell out of you. I'm going to beat the hell out of your wife and your son and your daughter that are there. And I'll do it all before the cops get there, believe me. So he caved. And like I said, this is the man I'm challenging. You know, I mean, What a macho thing to do, right? So he told me where she was, at Gibson House for Women. So I went over there, and I just parked out front, you know, like I'm reading the newspaper or something. And pretty soon somebody from inside the house comes out. So, excuse me, sir, you need to leave. And I go, why, it's a public road, isn't it? It's a public street. I'm just sitting here reading the newspaper. She goes, Dan, leave. And I didn't know this lady. And she knew who I was. So it dawned on me, oh, Christy must have told her that's my boyfriend up there. So anyhow, she spent 50-some-odd days in there, but I would go by at night and tuck a $20 bill in the back of a pack of cigarettes for her and throw it over the fence, you know, enabling. I would go on weekends to visit until they asked me not to return. You know, it was the middle of December, and I went on a weekend visit, and I was in a tank top with sweat stains down to my waist, and my eyes were bugged out of my head. And they go, well, she said, they would really appreciate it if you didn't come back. I go, why not? And they go, well, they seem to think you might still be under the influence or something. And I'm going, okay. So that was pretty much the end of my visits to the Gibson House. When she got out, she found this thing called, well, no, before I left there, she gave me a director of meetings. She goes, here, you want to try this, you might like them. And so I picked my very first meeting very cautiously. It was a 10:30 at night, Saturday night, 10:30, men's stag, over on Lawton Avenue in Redlands, California. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, there's not going to be too many people there at 10:30 on a Saturday night. So I got ready for the meeting, you know. I did 3 or 4 shots of Jack and a couple bowls of speed, and, you know, got tuned up. And I was right. I went over there, and there was 3 guys there. And they introduced themselves to me. And as I saw them later in life at the conventions and stuff, yeah, we introduced ourselves to you, and then you did all the talking the rest of the night. Don't know how that happened. But before I left there, they gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you ought to try reading this. You might find something in there that you can relate to. I did that night. I was spun out, so I read the whole entire big book that one night. So I started going to meetings. You know, I would call Christy up asking for a date. Come on, baby, let's, you know, go hook up or something. And she's like, no, my sponsor says I can't have any new relationships in the first year. And I go, this is not a new relationship. This is an ongoing relationship. And she goes, here. And she hands a phone to this woman. And this woman asked me one question. She goes, what do you have to offer this woman and these children? And I'm thinking for a second. And by this time, I'm living in an old 78 Ford van behind the Colton Friendship Club. And I'm going, well, I don't think all 4 of us will fit in here. So I didn't know what to say, so I called her a bitch and I hung up. But I spent 4 months in that van, living in that van. I had my army mummy sleeping bag for a bed. I had a styrofoam ice chest for a refrigerator. And if there's any tweakers in the room, you know you can't run away from home without your rollaway toolbox. So that wasn't there. Now, I did not have a sponsor yet. I was just attending these meetings and listening to what these people have to say and, you know, stuff like that. And every time I would make a left turn into that Colton Friendship Club, that toolbox would fall over, big old rollaway. All the tools would go scattering everywhere, and I'm like, oh, my God. So I'd have to, after a meeting, I'm out there cleaning them all up, placing them specifically in their spots and stuff like that. And this old guy, Jim, he would come by and he'd look at me and he'd look in the van and he'd just shake his head and walk off. And finally, one day, I guess he couldn't take it anymore. He says, you know, you see that piece of rope you got laying under your driver's seat? Yeah. He says, well, if you tie it through the hole of that post and then go around the front of that toolbox and tie it in the hole on that post back there, he goes, that won't happen anymore. I said, God damn, you're a genius. Will you be my sponsor? And luckily for me, Jim agreed. So I got to move in with Jim. Christy and I stayed separated for our first year of sobriety. I didn't think it was necessary because I didn't really think there was anything wrong with me. I mean, in fact, I was one of those people that always thought if there was more people like me in the world would be a better place. That was very short-lived. Jim got me into the end of the steps and working on myself. And, you know, it seems like everything that I think is the worst thing that could happen to me turns out to be one of the best, because I did not believe Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be good for me or be the best thing that's ever happened to me, but it is. So anyhow, Christy and I stayed apart for the first year. She said it was for bad behavior that we stayed apart. We spent 10 years together drinking, using, and abusing each other. 10 years. And we're back together till this day, and we've been together now for 41 years. And we've been married for 25 of it. So we had a 16-year engagement. Because I'd given her a diamond ring when we first got together. You know, that crap about diamonds are forever? Nah, don't work. So when we decided we were going to get married, we need a new ring. I'm going, well, you have a ring. She goes, that one's no good. You gave me that, and, you know, when we were still drinking and using and stuff. And I go, it's still a diamond? I mean, come on. So we go to the jewelry store, and this lady, you know, we're looking at some stones in our price range, and Christy's looking at the rings, and the lady's going, so how long have you guys been engaged? And I go, about 16 years. She goes, oh, hell no, honey, you need to look at these. And she puts up. Anyhow, we got back together, and you know, I learned how to be a father in this program. I learned how to treat my kids like human beings, you know, not like with my first two girls, you know, it was the stare. You look at them and they know to shut up and cower in a corner or something, you know, don't bother. These kids, that didn't happen to. These kids, I was taught in these rooms how to be a dad. But anyhow, it... as Tori turned 12, she decided to go visit her biological father up in Seattle. And I told Christy, I said, she won't be back. I said, she won't be back. That was the age I left and came, you know, went to my dad. And I'm going, I don't think she'll be back, honey. We got home, and shortly after, the phone was ringing, and Christy answered it. And it was our daughter, Tori, and she was crying her eyes out and wanting to speak to me. And I said, what's this about? So I get on the phone, and she's just bawling, bawling. She goes, Dad, you're my dad. I don't want to be here. He's not my dad. You're my dad. He may be my father, but you're my dad. And I want to come home. Since that day, God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. He changed that little girl's heart of hate from one of hate to one of love in a short plane ride to Seattle. Since that day, Tori and I, you would not know she's not my own child. I mean, just amazing things. There was a part in my life that I didn't care for Asian-looking people much, just due to Vietnam and some things that happened there. And this is back when I'm still in my disease and stuff, but I was. This is another one of those miracles in my life that I didn't realize was a miracle until I got sober. So I was out on a job site on Ortega Highway. We were doing a job down there building another road. And the foreman got me in his truck and asked me to go down here and get this area set up. You know, I was on a grade checker. I was reading the plans and scaling stuff off, you know, various distances and putting those wooden stakes in the ground so the scrapers, when they came in with the dirt, would know where to dump it. So he drops me off there and tells me to get it ready. And so I throw my bags on and I'm standing there, and I guess I went into a trance, daydream, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I was high, don't get me wrong. I was wired and had nothing but Jack Daniels in my water jug. So I started, thought I started, but evidently I didn't. I went into a daze, and I was back in Vietnam, and I was doing everything that those people were doing when I was there, because I had my two little girls with me in that type of a zone. You know, a war zone is a horrible place for a kid to grow up. And believe me, I was doing everything they were doing and more, just to protect those two kids, to feed them, to get them a place to sleep, clothe them. And about that time, this pickup truck comes sliding back up. He's the foreman. He goes, Dan, he says, I told you to get this ready for scrapers. And I said, well, I will. Give me a minute, will you? He goes, you've been here an hour and a half. You haven't moved. I said, well, I'll move now. I got to go. And I had to run to my dope man's house to get a, you know, rebuzz or something because this wasn't working. But I didn't realize what that meant until I got sober. Sobriety has given me so many kinds of gifts like that. So, where are we at? There. No, we're right here. Oh, God. So, Christy and I have a nice little house over in Colton, and we're raising our children, and they want to play sports. They're playing softball, basketball. And, you know, we found it amazing that we found time. We went to a meeting every day of the week for 7 years straight and still had time to get those kids to their practices, go to their plays, be at their events. I don't know how we did it. Even today, I can't even imagine how we did that, but we did. So we had a lot of stuff that was boxed up still in the garage, you know, from our old house. And so we're out there one day, and all the neighbor kids are hanging out with our girls, and they're in the driveway and in the garage playing around and stuff. And Christy's over there unpacking a bunch of old stuff, and she pulls a blanket or a towel or something out of a box, and I hear this clink, 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 clink. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I turn around, and there it was, pipe full of speed, just already melted down, ready to go. And she snatches it up. And, of course, all the kids, what's that? What's that? Oh, it's just a piece of glass that broke, you know. We're done with it. But things like that. But the thing is, when Christy and I decided to get married, the first thing I did was, we were at our Monday night meeting, and her sponsor had mentioned to her that she needed to quit living in sin. So they asked me to come up to the podium to share, and my wife sits right where you're sitting at our meeting. And so I said, excuse me a minute, you know, and I went over and I got down on one knee in front of her, in front of the entire meeting, and I said, will you marry me? And she goes, yes, if you'll get up. And so that's how I started. So anyhow, the next thing I did was I went to her father, the man that I threatened with bodily injury, and he stood up with tears running down his face and said, I can't think of a better man to marry my daughter than you. And that's just how much the program had changed me. You know, my outlook on life is so amazing today. It doesn't matter what problem comes along. You know, God has a way for me to get through it one way or another. My brother had to move in with us. He's a lot younger than me. He's like 20 years younger than me. And he had a stroke and a heart attack in Seattle in the 1st of July. And then he was moving in with us at the 1st of August. And he came in on a Sunday, and by Monday I had him at Loma Linda Hospital. And he flatlined twice in the ER. His lungs were full of blood clots. I mean, two-thirds blocked. And I went from a Life of Riley retirement to a, holy crap, I really got to get going now. And through it all, I had the energy I needed to do it and the willingness to do it, and it wasn't any problem for me. But that's all due to the man upstairs. When we moved to our house in Beaumont, and this is no joke, and it's I've mentioned it before, and people just can't believe it, but we put a bid in on a house out in Beaumont, and the day we put our bid in, it went off the market. And our realtor calls us, they just pulled it off the market. We, you know, couldn't get our bid in. Okay. Well, at the time, I was working in Yuma, so I was driving out on Sunday nights. And every Sunday afternoon, as I'm going past there, I would stop and go by the house. Excuse me. Go by the house and make sure nobody was moving in it. Luckily, there wasn't. I probably would have got arrested as a peeping Tom or something because I was in the backyard peeking through the windows and stuff, you know. See if there was any furniture in there and stuff. And then every Friday night coming home, I would do the same thing. And this went on for like 3 months. And finally, one Friday night, I'm headed home, and I stop by there, and nobody's still moving in or anything. And I just, beautiful sunset over behind our house, over the foothills. And I just said, God, if this is what you want for us, I need some help. My cell phone rang. It was my realtor, said the house just came back on the market. It wasn't a coincidence to me. Not to me. There's too many things There's too many things. I'll tell you another one. These are just little stories that make me feel the way I feel inside. My brother, like I said, has had a bunch of problems. So we were on our way back to Loma Linda, and he was talking to me about some problems he had going on in his head and his heart, you know. And I kept telling him, I said, Bill, you know, he goes, I don't know. Why am I here? I don't understand. I go, you're here because God's not done with you yet. And he has a plan for you. He just hasn't told you what it is yet. And right about that time, a car pulls into our lane on the freeway, and on its license plate, it says, okay to be you. And I pointed that out, and I said, you see that license plate? He goes, oh, man, that's great. I said, yeah. And believe me what, it's not a coincidence, brother. That's a personal message as far as I'm concerned. And I always tell people that I have a hotline to God. It seems that way sometimes. I mean, when my brother was flatlining, you know, the surgeons were all coming out of the room, and they see I had a little something in my eye or something, you know, rolling down my cheek, and they would go, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. I'm doing great. They go, would you like us to pray with you? I said, it's not necessary. I said, I got a hotline to God. He's already told me everything's going to be okay. And they just looked at me, you know, like, would you like to go to visit our mental ward or something? Oh, my God. What am I leaving out? You? Oh. Huh? Akron. That's it. Thank you. That's some of the great things we get to do in the program. I have the privilege of sponsoring some great, great guys in this program. And here a couple years ago, Kevin, myself, Trenton, and another sponsee named Eddie Perea, we all jumped on a plane and flew to Akron, Ohio to do the Dr. Bob tour. We ended up staying with a lady that ran the tour. Didn't cost us anything for a hotel. Kevin pushed me down the stairs the day we were leaving, and I got all bloody and then bled all over the plane, and they wanted to throw us off mid-flight. No, he didn't push me down. I fell down. It was dark in the morning. But we fit in 3 days. 3 days, we saw everything there was to see in Akron. We even snuck into the chapel when it was still in that hospital, and it was during COVID. So when we went in there, you know, all the security guards are, who are you here to see? Well, no, we just, you can't be in here. Cool. So then finally the girl that we were staying with, she goes, no, you go in the front door, tell the security guards, I'm just going into the gift shop. You go in the gift shop, and if you look straight in the back, there's a door. And you open that door, and it leads right into the hallway that takes you to the chapel. So we're all in the chapel illegally. And we did a prayer, and there were all of us were just bawling. And same at Bob's house, we did a third-step prayer. I'm out of time. I want to thank you all so much for being here for me tonight. I appreciate your welcoming. You guys were just kind as could be, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.